Hey friends, this is Shadima, also known as the Type A Hippie, and this is the Type A Hippie podcast, the ChiCast episode 11. And I'm here with one of my favorite people, Carly Keys. She is a singer-songwriter and also just won the Lightworks, did I get it right this time? Lightworks Film Festival for a student, not a publication, but she did a TV pilot called Recovering. And so I had the pleasure of seeing it Friday night. And I'll tell you that I had tears in my eyes at the end of it because it was so good. And just that quickly, the next second, I was not so happy with Carly because it was over. And I wanted to watch the next episode. I tend to be a binge watcher of episodes, right? So anyway, I'm here with Carly, and we met through friends of friends, probably when I first moved back to Ann Arbor. And let's see, we've sat on several panels together. Most recently, we were at St. Joe's as part of their teaching series. And so we are both very interested in advocating for people with substance use disorder, but also helping to educate the professional community about substance use disorder. So we've sat on several panels together and laughed and talked our way through it. So everyone, meet Carly Keys.
Hello, it's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah, of course, of course.
So friends, in a spirit of transparency, this is take two. So we're in early beginnings, as I've mentioned several times, and we're sitting in the public library, and we were in one room, and then we transferred to another room, and because I paused the podcast recording device, it didn't tape the whole second half of our podcast. Yes. So it taped 18 out of 53 minutes of it.
So then you and I will just share the rest of the 36 minutes or 37
exactly.
minutes.
Yeah. Exactly. So we decided we would just start over again. We have our Perrier, we have our water with spearmint oil from doTERRA, so we're good to go. We're set up.
Locked
I have brownies and we're locked and loaded. So I wanted Carly to tell us about, because, you know, I'm all about conversations, and so we'll talk probably about some stuff about substance use disorder. We'll definitely talk about recovering. We'll talk about her music and what that means to her, kind of her own journey and path from being in the disease of alcoholism through recovery and what that's looked like for her. And then we'll end up probably talking about a lot of different things because that's just what we do here.
We're just here to explore.
We're here to explore and just have fun conversations, organic conversations. Sometimes difficult ones, you know. So, yeah. Carly, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so I am 28, and I am a singer-songwriter. That was my first love, really, was music.
Awesome.
My first love was, like, drawing and telling stories and really when I was a kid and they told you to, it was funny, it was kind of ironic, they asked you to draw a picture of what you wanted to be when you grew up.
Sure.
I was in kindergarten, I think, and I drew a picture of me being an artist, and that's what I wanted to be when I was a kid before anyone told me you can't make money at that, or you can't, how are you gonna, you know, all those fear-based questions, guys.
Sure.
That was what I wanted to be. And anyway, now I kind of full circle came back after being in business school at the Wharton School of Business, where I was playing Division I soccer and all these, you know, really awesome achievements, but they were very, very ego driven. And all I really wanted to do since I was a kid was be an artist. And so thankfully I kind of full circle came back. One of my favorite quotes of all time is, not all those who wander are lost, which is Tolkien. Yeah, I love that quote. And I kind of did some wandering, and now through all that wandering, it just informs my stories. And so now I know, like, my purpose here is to, you know, I want to write and produce visual stories, television, streaming, whatever it is called these days, movies, thank God those still exist.
Right.
You know, and the theaters and all those things. Yeah, and that's what I do today is I try to take stories that I find interesting. Some of them, everything has a little bit of me in it. I don't think it's possible to not have a little bit of me in the stuff I do. And Recovering, which is the TV pilot we just wrapped on and that you saw, and thank you for coming and the kind words and everything. And that's my latest project. And that is very much based on a lot of me,
right.
I guess you would say. So yeah, that's really who I am, and thankfully I got to fuse some of my music with recovering, which is just a joy, because one of my favorite movies is this movie called Once. And
if
you've
seen it.
You got to see it. It's by this director, John Carney, and it's about Glenn Hansard, one of my favorite musicians, plays this Irish singer-songwriter who's struggling, and he meets this young woman played by Markéta Orgulova, and you know, she inspires him to kind of go after his dream. And I saw that movie, and it's basically sort of like a modern movie musical, and all the songs are organic, and I saw that, and I was like, that's what I want to do. I want to make movies like that. And so recovering the pilot, I got to kind of fuse, along with a really talented composer and singer-songwriter, Jerry Arlen. He thankfully, graciously let me kind of put one of my own songs in the pilot, and worked with our actor, and it really shows on screen. I think that was where the tears kind of came at the end.
Yeah, no, it was so beautiful.
So that's what I'm about. That's what I do. And
tell us about Recovering.
Okay, so Recovering, a one-hour drama. And I could see it's got like a cable streaming vibe, not as much network, but you never know these days, as everything tries to be edgier to compete, I think.
Sure.
Recovering is about a woman named Kelly Claremont, and she is a young woman who is the adult child of an alcoholic.
Okay.
And that informs a lot of her behavior today.
Sure.
A lot of perfectionist tendencies, a lot of control issues, and
caretaking,
all those things. And naturally, she is a therapist, right? Because that's like what you
naturally.
Do. And she runs this small 6-bed treatment center in upstate Vermont. And it's about her adventures, so to speak, her personal adventures before and after, I guess you
sure.
would say. And she runs it with her ex-boyfriend, Bradley.
That was interesting. Was really interesting to me.
So again, with the exposition, because pilots are about a lot of exposition, getting the details of the world out there. Who's who? What are they doing? Later on in the episode, you find out that they actually dated.
Sure.
And now they're running this place together, and that creates working with your ex, right?
Right.
But for the greater cause, so they
That's
think
right.
it's fine. And there's a woman that works
and
in the
kitchen.
And
both are in relationships.
Yeah, and both are in
new relationships. Yeah.
And so it's sort of like they're talking about it, but they're not talking about it. And there's a woman, Diana, who runs the kitchen.
I love her character.
She's badass.
Yes, she is.
Isn't she?
Yeah,
I tell
she
you,
is.
That actress, she is so talented. And she came to the audition, and she had on, like, the outfit that I could see Diana wearing, and I was like, yeah. I think we're done here. Like, I think
yeah.
she's the one. So she runs the kitchen, and she's kind of Callie's.
But then she has a softer side to her, too.
She does.
I love how the characters were multi-layered. Like, there's more than what meets the eye. I mean, you want to peel back the layers and get to know them,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a mark of and a sign of good work.
Mm.
It's not like, oh, I've already seen this before. Like, I already know the blonde and I already know the girl, you know, this
stereotypes
one. And yeah,
kind of.
Exactly. Like, there's more.
Mm.
And even the relationship between Callie and her sister.
Oh, Lucille.
I want to know.
Lucille is a talent agent in LA.
Sure.
So there, she's the older sister. And we definitely get to see what their relationship is like now. You know, obviously if Callie was the adult child of an alcoholic, so was Lucille, and how they've sort of taken those experiences as children and gone kind of opposite ends of the same spectrum. You know, Lucille took it and is sort of like using her those power trip tendencies in like sort of like a very opportunist way,
sure.
whereas Callie is overtly using them in kind of an optimistic, like,
sure.
you know. It's,
but
so
what's
it's
interesting to me is that they're both caretakers in their own right, just
Indeed.
In a different manner.
Indeed.
So taking care of, as an agent in LA, who are you taking care of? You're likely taking care of celebrities.
Yeah.
And what does that look like
right.
compared to taking care of clients mm-hmm. in a treatment facility?
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. And so, yeah, so Lucille, her main, like, project is this guy, Jones Ward.
Sure.
Who is this rock star who is, like, famously sober, you know? Like we see those celebrities that, and most of them are just, like, I'm sure, I don't want to speak for them, I'm sure they're just like, man, just let me do my thing and live my life. But,
sure.
but the press likes to, you know, and thankfully some of them, I think, do use it in a positive
yeah.
way and be like, listen, like, okay, what I do, you it speaks to you, whoever the you is, the millions of fans and listeners or watchers, if it's an actor or a singer or anything. And we feel, like I know I feel closer to people that I respect their art, and I find out they get sober, and I'm like, oh my God. And you have the because of that kindred bond that is someone like me who's in recovery. I feel like I have this, like the artist bond is incredible. Yeah, and then to be like a sober artist, it's it's amazing. So this guy Jones Ward is sort of this famously sober rock star.
Yeah.
And that's what leads to him coming to the treatment center.
And wanting to pay it forward.
And wanting to pay it forward, which is, you know, good PR for him. And we found out there's a lot of ulterior motives, and the key to a good drama is a lot of like allocation of information. Like who knows what. So we find out that like Callie knows her financial problems. Diana knows, Bradley doesn't know, and Diana knows Bradley doesn't know. And so it's a lot of like situational irony where like a certain character has more
information
than another, and you're just waiting for that bomb to explode.
Yep. And it does.
And it sure does. Yeah.
And I don't even think I know the full extent of it because we only got the pilot.
The pilot. You know? Yeah, yeah. I mean, oh, yeah. And that's the tough thing is you just want to fit it all in. Like, there's so much there. And we don't even get to, like, a lot of the backstories and minor characters, that stuff. You just have to keep watching. So.
Totally. Well, one thing that was interesting to me is that Friends, this, the setting of recovering is in a treatment facility. And I talked with Ashton Mara last week, and so that's episode 10, and we actually talked about you, Carly, because we're all three friends in common,
that's
and
sweet.
We've all done a lot of work, not necessarily together, all of us, but we're connected because of our passion and purpose for sharing the stories of those in recovery and demonstrating that, I mean, we know that a third of Americans are touched by the disease of alcoholism or addiction. Or substance use disorder, you know. So this is something that we need to be talking more about, not less about. Mm-hmm. This is something that I feel very called to destigmatize, whether I'm doing it single-handedly or with others, and I would much rather be doing it with others. And so that's a reason that I invited Carly to come on. So recovering is set at a treatment facility. And it also provides a vantage point from the staff's perspective, but also from the client or patient perspective, which is really interesting. And one of the things Ashton and I talked about last week was that there's so many barriers to treatment.
Indeed.
So I thought of the most obvious, which is financial.
Yeah.
And so maybe someone who's uninsured is struggling, right? Because, I mean, one of the reasons that they're probably struggling is because they're uninsured. And one of the reasons that they're uninsured is because they're struggling financially, right?
So it's a catch-22.
And then also the cost. So some people that are even insured. And so I think this is one of the things that has come up with recent political changes, right? Is that there's this segment of population that feels like they're unheard.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there are segments of population that have felt unheard for decades, right?
Yeah, right.
And so that's why we need to all start coming together and talking about this more.
I agree.
And so there are people that are working poor of all different backgrounds and cultures. And so they may have insurance, but barely, and treatment may or may not be covered, or a portion may not, you know, so the portion that's covered, that's great. But you can only do, I mean, you can't do 60% of the treatment, right?
No,
like,
right.
You need to make up the other 40%. And so that might be the barrier.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ashton brought up something that I hadn't even thought about, was that space, like actually having space, like a physical bed, because two people are not going to share a bed.
Right.
So if there's one bed, and there are four people that need that one bed, three people are not going to get the bed.
Right.
And then there's also this piece of a level of willingness and being open to treatment, right?
Mm.
So there has to be, I feel like the more we're talking about it, and this is one of the reasons that I think Carly's piece is so, so imperative to be shown. So she had a Kickstarter project early on. I don't know if they're still accepting money, but Carly, you'll have to tell us if we can, you know, how we can give money, because this work of art needs to be shown to the masses, period.
That.
End of story. Because when people know, when we know better, we tend to do better. Not always, as I've seen in recent days, sadly. I was talking with a friend a couple days ago, and she said, Chidima, I'm losing faith in God, and I'm losing faith in humanity. And I was like, nope, we have that hashtag, Hope Rising, for a reason. Mm-hmm. Hope is stirring. These conversations are multiplying themselves. And whether it's through a TV program for an hour, I mean, we talked about This Is Us. You know, yeah. I read a blog post about it the other day, yesterday, and it was like, she wrote in all caps, you must stop what you're doing right now and watch This Is Us, right? And it's because it's so relatable. People are like, oh my gosh, I've struggled with my weight, whether I've been too skinny, which that has been me, or I felt like I was on the other end, you know? And thankfully, I don't have the experience, and I feel for people that are overweight, are obese, are morbidly obese, and what that struggle looks like. Mm-hmm. I watched a clip, and you could probably do a Google search. It'll be linked to this podcast. Whenever I reference something, just know I will do my best to collate it and put it all together so that you can access it later. So I'll have Carly's contact information if you need music or if you want to show a screening of Recovering in your area. Mm-hmm. And then how to reach out to her directly, maybe her website or an email address if she feels comfortable with that. And then also, so I watched this clip about, and it's called, and this is the title that they posted. It's not a title that I would use. It's something along the effects of flying while fat. Mm. And so it shows, and it's the voices are people that consider themselves to be overweight. Mm-hmm. Obese or morbidly obese. And so those are actual real diagnoses with ICD-10 codes. And there's a, as a clinician or a healthcare professional, those are actual, you know, it's not just someone trying to be mean. And so, you know, they talk about seat extenders. They talk about some people being forced to purchase a second seat. Mm-hmm. And just kind of the looks that the general public gives that are of more, I would say, average weight. And they, you know, kind of like wishing, hoping that this person is not next to you. Mm-hmm. And when I say that, it's like this person, they're a human being, they're human. Right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I talk about in a previous episode about privilege.
Right.
And one of the privileges that I personally experience or enjoy is that I'm of average size. Mm-hmm. I don't ever worry about my size in relation to other people. Mm-hmm. I don't need to sneak past or suck my breath in or anything like that because I fit pretty much everywhere, you know? It's something that I don't even think about. And so people relate to Kate for that reason, right? Yeah. They relate to, you know, and so it's more conversation about size and then conversation about race and inclusion with Randall.
Well, I think it's interesting, just that phrase, that I fit, right? You meant that in a physical way, but like in a metaphorical sense. Totally. And I think that's one of the things that I really wanted to do with Recovering was the idea of like a lot... Everyone here kind of feels like they don't fit in the world. And
let me interject.
Sure.
Hold that thought. Don't forget it.
I will not.
I don't fit in a lot of arenas.
Almost set my Perrier. That was great.
So that is the truth, you know, and that's like the nature of privilege. Like,
it is the nature of privilege.
I do not fit, and I feel wildly uncomfortable in a lot of arenas in my life.
Sure.
And I felt more so uncomfortable, I would say, over 10 years ago when my life was not on the trajectory that is right now, right?
Yeah.
So continue with what you're saying.
And that's why when I went to treatment for the first time for alcoholism when I was 20 years old, right?
Yeah. And it seems so young, and it's not.
It seems so young, but it's not. And when I was 20 years old...
Did you say that you were not one of the youngest?
I was not one of the youngest. So I got there and feeling like... Okay, I knew I didn't belong. I was 20 years old, and I couldn't drink like I always got in trouble.
Sure.
Right? I just wanted to get drunk like the normal 20, like the normal, which I heard is just a setting on a washing machine.
Sure.
Right? Like,
yep,
that's what I was told when I got there.
I love that.
But, you know, I was like, I don't fit. If I don't drink, I don't fit in because I'm 20 years old and I should be drinking. But if I do drink, I don't fit in either because it's like, I drink too much, but that's how I want to drink. And it was just a very weird... place, like I didn't belong in either realm, right? And so when I got to treatment for the first time, I finally felt like I belonged somewhere. I was like, oh my God, you all understand.
You're speaking my language.
What I'm going through, we're speaking the same language. Sure. When I say something like, I don't understand people that can't finish a glass of wine. Like, sure. I literally don't understand that. Like, what a waste of wine, A. B, like, you just...
Carly, you're like, that's alcohol abuse right there.
Yeah, like, exactly. When abuse... You want to talk about alcohol abuse, mm-hmm. not finishing a glass of wine. Sure. Like, that's how I think. Like, that's a crime. You know, sure. that's a real crime. Yeah. So, you know, so one of the things I wanted to show with recovering was, like, this is a place where everyone who feels like they don't fit in the real world can come, and that's why, like, it's so important to yeah. Callie that when she runs into financial ruin that we need to save this place.
Totally.
And I just... But there can also be, you know, sort of a disadvantage to that in the sense that, like, eventually you can't live in rehab.
Sure.
You know, I do my best as someone that partakes in a 12-step program. I sure. sort of have these little mini rehab sure. experiences for like an yeah. hour a day, or if I'm mm-hmm. sitting with a compatriot, or if I'm
yeah,
sitting
totally.
At coffee or something, I mm-hmm. have these, like, you know, portable rehab,
right,
I guess.
Sure.
But you know, when I leave, there's a liquor store in the corner.
Totally.
There's going to be hardship that makes me want to act out. And,
sure.
and so you know, these things exist for a reason. That's why,
yeah.
you know, your conversation with Ash, I mean, it, you know, I address a lot of those issues in the pilot,
yeah.
you know, and in fact, when Callie needs money from her sister,
yeah.
she lies and says it's they're trying to expand to serve
sure.
more patients, so her sister doesn't know she really is broke, right?
Totally.
So I think, and reflecting on it, sometimes when you're in the middle of these processes of writing, you're just like hoping you cover as much as you
yeah.
can, and I think that, you know, it really did kind of succeed in the long run in sort of addressing a lot of the major issues. I mean, we find out at the end of the episode why Callie does this.
Sure.
And that she's one of the three that's been deeply affected
by
the barriers of receiving
yeah.
treatment.
Yeah.
That's all I'll say about that. But I definitely, as someone myself who has had so many friends need treatment, and their first thing is, I can't pay for it.
Totally.
I don't have insurance.
Yeah.
My parents aren't, you know, and this
wealthy.
Is not against,
yeah,
my parents can't afford it. I'm not going to drain my parents' savings again. And, you know, and so it's what, yeah, what can we do to, A, make treatment more affordable, make it more accessible, up the number of beds, and B, decriminalize a public health crisis.
That's right.
Right? And that's part of my story. I'm not ashamed to say that I had two drunk driving arrests when I was in my addiction, and that I served jail time. And, like, you know, I broke the law, and it could have been, and I'm grateful, it could have been a lot worse, right? But at the same time, like, you know, I wish there was a way to at least hybridize so you don't just throw a bunch of sick people in the criminal justice system
right.
and give them no form of support. You know, as soon as I got into jail, I asked the people, I said, where is there a meeting? When is the meeting? And they were like, oh, you're going to have to get on a list. And I was like, I have to get on a list to get to a 12-step meeting in here? And they were like, yeah, it'll be, you know, probably a week or so you can get. And I'm like, I don't get it. It doesn't cost money. Like, can't we all just put everyone in the same room here that wants to get better? And, it, you
right.
know, maybe affect some other people. And it was very, very eye-opening, that experience for me, and seeing how you're just putting a lot of sick people, you know, mostly 80%, I would say, in a place where they're not given many resources to help, you know, and then you wonder why recidivism is so high. So,
exactly.
Yeah, I hope that, you know, with fiction, I think there's a lot of truth in fiction, and it becomes sort of a really safe way for people to hear truth.
Yeah.
Is in fiction. Sometimes
Absolutely.
It's a safer way, and so I hope that with what I'm doing that some of these issues can be brought to light through.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, that's what, so one of my friends that I am going to introduce you to mm-hmm. used to write for Black-ish.
Oh, you said,
and
yeah.
I love that show because it talked about some of the more difficult conversations,
yeah.
like the N-word and why it really shouldn't be used by anyone, you know?
yeah.
And issues of race and issues of class and the intersection of both, because...
Yeah.
They're a very wealthy family. Like, mm-hmm. he is, I forget what
Anthony Anderson.
Anderson's character plays, but he's, like, a VP at, like, in a marketing
advertising
firm.
Or marketing or something?
Yeah,
I can't remember
advertising
either.
Advertising firm, I believe.
Yeah.
And his wife is a physician.
Yeah.
You know, and they have four children, and just taking a look at that, you know, I mean, I'm from Ann Arbor,
yeah.
you know, and I've said this multiple times, and it probably rubs people the wrong way, and I'm okay with it. And where are you from? Bloomfield Hills?
I'm from Bloomfield Hills.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm from a really, I had a very privileged upbringing. I went to a private school. Like, I understand that now.
Right?
You know? I didn't at the time.
Oh, yeah. No, me
at
either.
14,
me
15, either. 16, but now
so
I do.
So Ann Arbor, probably the median income is $100,000. I would say Bloomfield Hills might be double that. Probably. Right?
It's up there.
It's definitely... So Oakland County, out of all of the counties in the state of Michigan, Oakland County has that highest median income.
Yeah.
And is the wealthiest. And so you have a lot of cities like Bloomfield, Bloomfield Hills, Troy, Birmingham in Oakland County. So apart from that, I would say Ann Arbor is a close, but not even, like, they rub elbows a little bit.
Yeah. They'll say hi at parties.
But you would have people in both of those places. I would say, so more in Ann Arbor, you have really wealthy people amongst you that you don't even know are wealthy.
You don't.
You have people that have buildings named after them, and they have ripped shoes and ripped jeans.
Yep.
Like, they just don't in Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
Now, in Bloomfield Hills and Beham and Troy, it's slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
There is more display of wealth,
sure.
shall we
yeah.
put it?
Yeah.
Slightly different arena, but it's all good.
Yeah.
And so... We mention these things because there are so many, like, even with that said, so my parents emigrated from Nigeria, born and raised there, they're naturalized citizens.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so grateful that they're citizens, especially with what's happening in the world right now and in this country.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you that they were able to manage their money, save, and purchase 2 houses in a week.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
And even still, and they both have PhDs now.
Wow.
At the time, they didn't. I think my dad had a PhD and my mom had a master's.
Uh-huh.
Still highly educated. Even then, we lived in Ann Arbor and we were looking at houses.
Yeah.
They were steered towards Ypsilanti.
Mm-hmm.
Racism.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I don't know why people don't see it that way. Like, that's what it is, right?
Yeah.
And so having these conversations that are sometimes hella uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah, they're definitely uncomfortable.
You know, having 2 different roommates to me, and you talked about this, about recovering, and we'll kind of segue back into that.
Yeah.
Tell me, when I lived in Vegas, 2 separate living situations, 2 separate roommates that didn't know each other.
Yeah.
That they thought that I had some issues with food.
Yeah.
And that I might have body dysmorphia disorder. Mm-hmm. And that I don't eat real food. Like, they only see me with coffee. They only see me with reduced fat wheat thins or other snack foods that are, like, fat-free or reduced
which
fat.
Which have no nutritional content.
No
right?
nutritional value whatsoever.
Right, which are actually terrible for your body, right?
And I was working at, like, as part of my history, mm-hmm. I had a 20-year eating disorder. Mm-hmm. I only got healthy in 2014 from that.
Right.
More healthy. And I'll tell you that it's always a struggle.
Sure.
Because food is always around.
Yeah.
Like, I lost 10 pounds when I lived in California.
Yeah.
Because I was stressed.
Right.
And not eating. Like,
right.
to the point where my friends would have to remind me, have you eaten?
Right.
You know? My mom would call me and be like, have you eaten?
It's a much more different, it's a different monster because...
It's always around.
It's always around and you can't, like, you know, drugs and alcohol are just, you know, devastating. That being said, for me, it was a very simple and clear and, like, non-negotiable solution that, like, today I just don't drink.
Sure.
I don't put alcohol and drugs in my body, and it's very simple. It's not easy, but it's simple.
Yeah.
Food is much more difficult because it's just, you know, like, finding abstinence when there's so many different people out there, they're like, this is what's healthy, da-da-da, you know, and it's, I think it just comes down to you gotta find what works for you and just not worry about what people think about it.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, and that's one of the, you know, that I try to tackle as many of these sort of, like, myriad addictive tendencies and behavior. You know, you've got a 14-year-old in recovering in my pilot who suffers from depression,
mm-hmm.
and we kind of find out why at the end of the episode.
Okay.
You've got a young woman who's there for an eating disorder. You've got a young kid who's there, and he doesn't speak, and we're not really sure why, but he just doesn't talk, and we'll find out later, you know, hopefully in, like, the second or third episode why. You know, you've got a woman who's there, and she kind of is not so nice. And you're kind of wondering, you know, in the beginning, they say they're on behavioral contracts. Because we know it's more than just removing the substances, right? It's like they put them on behavioral contracts, which is sort of a reflection of a place I actually went to, which this is kind of amazing. But this place in Arizona, they give you...
This was the second rehab.
This is the second rehab I went to.
A year later at 21.
Okay. Yep, so I went back to rehab, which many people have multiple trips. I only had two. Which is, I think, safe to say, like, that's, I only had two. But when you got there, they put you in color groups, and they put you in groups based on your drug of choice and, like, behavioral issues. So I was in the green group with people that were mainly alcoholics and mainly had, like, for lack of a better term, like, relationship issues, like, addictions to people, like, sex and love addiction. And it just, it helped a lot, because when I said something... you know, that maybe someone else there can't exactly relate to. I was a bunch of people who were just like, oh my God, I totally get what you mean when, like, he texted you back and it wasn't enough. You know what I mean? Like those, and because even within this big sphere of addiction, there's these pockets and we're all alike, but some of us are more alike than others and some of us are more different than others, and there's always something we can learn, but it really helps when you just, like, find these people. You know, that behaviorally, because there's so much more than, like, substances, you know?
Well, and don't you find that in any circle, so whether we're sitting together talking with some of our other friends or, you know, and when you say something, there's such power in me too.
Oh, absolutely.
When I say, oh, yes, I struggled with exercise bulimia, and you have that same experience or something similar, right? And you say me too, then I feel less alone. Now there's two of us that at least minimum feel the same way and likely will have more. So that now we're having a talk or a conversation about this thing that once separated me from you, where I didn't feel like I am you and you are me and there are no others and there's no us versus them. Now we're on the same side, right? And so then it's just us. And then there's freedom for more of the truth to come out. Slowly but surely. So that some of the stigma is, like, some of the shame gets lightened. Like, I lighten, so this burden and the shame and the secret that I've been hanging on to, I mean, it took me a while to say that I had a struggle with an eating disorder. And I know that the perfect storm happened when I was bullied in seventh grade. Like, I was bullied significantly.
And that's a storyline in my pilot that I just can't get to in the pilot. It's one of the reasons why Aaron is there. The young kid who doesn't speak. And it's not what you think. Like, it's I tried to flip that storyline on its head. With the idea that, like, he looks kind of nerdy. That was a conscious choice. Was like, to have this young kid come in, he looks kind of nerdy. It's like, why are you here? He's got glasses and stuff. And it's like, well, today...
And he looks like he's put together,
and
right?
He looks like he's put together. And today, it's like, you know, so much bullying takes place on the internet. And so it's a lot easier to be bullied. And even, like, people are having a hard time defining, like, what is harassment? Like, when you know, like, report on Facebook and Google and stuff, and it's like, how do you discern, like, what is actually harassment? It's a very, like, gray, and it's hard to define it sometimes, I think. But
it's
This kid, you know, I was like, what if he was the bully? You know, what if he's there because he bullied someone on the internet and he's just at home and he knows how to hack things and he hacks and makes a, you know, meme of, you know what I mean? Like, and what if that's why he's there? Because someone that he internet bullied did something and tried to hurt themselves and he just decided to stop talking. You know, and so it's taking these, you know, sort of traditional concepts and I'm trying to spin them and make it something you haven't seen before, or maybe something that's more current that you didn't see on a show that you love but ran like 5 years ago. And we didn't have things like Snapchat then. And it's trying to, like, embrace change. Because I'm very traditionalist. Like, I'm still someone that, like, listens to the same music I listened to in high school. Like, the Goo Goo Dolls and, like, the Fray from 2006 or whatever. Like, I still, like, I'm very traditionalist. So I'm trying to learn to, like, embrace newer things that, like, the world's changing. And it's like, I either am going to embrace it or I'm not, and I'm trying to like move more towards embracing it.
Well, and what you're doing is very progressive, because, like I was saying, that when I was bullied, I stopped eating. I only ate one meal a day. I couldn't stomach breakfast. Lunch got tossed the painstaking lunch that my mom put together for me got tossed in the garbage.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I was walking into. It almost felt like war every day for me. Mm-hmm. And that kicked it off. That started this eating disorder because the one thing I could control, I couldn't control people. I couldn't control places.
Yeah.
You know, all I could control was what I put in my mouth. And for whatever reason, that's what I chose to control.
Yeah.
And so I was like that for over 20 years.
Yeah.
Is like, well, I can control what I put in my mouth.
And it's
and I can restrict. And that is what I did.
Yeah. You know? And it's these process addictions, right? Like sure. like people, places, things.
We're food, all in recovery. That's internet. What I say.
Well, and that's the theme. And it was interesting because the show used to be called Unplugged. Mm-hmm. And I thought, and it was this idea of like stripping down this rock musician Jones Ward, stripping him down and getting him raw and unplugged. And there's actually there's a line in the script about it still, which I'm glad that the show's it original title is it made it in. But after a while my professor was like, it's not really about, it's about Callie, it's about this protagonist, it's, it makes it sound like it's too much about the rock star. And he goes, you should just call it recovering. And I was like, you're right. And he goes, because isn't like the theme of your show, like we're all recovering from something?
That's right.
Because if you look at all the characters on the staff, you've got Callie, who's recovering from being the adult child of an alcoholic. You've got, you know, Diana, who at the end we find out used to drive her motorcycle drunk. You've got Bradley, who clearly when he types in, is monogamy even possible? Like people Google those things because they're just in like a moment of desperation where they just want, you know, someone to talk to them, even if it's Google. And so you've got everyone on the staff even is recovering from something. And you've got the rock star is, Lucille, the agent is, all the patients are. And it's true that we are all recovering from something and that it's just... It's only until we let people know and talk about
that's right.
That we get healing.
That's right. When we let the walls down and we say what's really going on, and sometimes it just takes a moment of clarity, a moment of desperation, a moment of the divine, you know, whether it's like in a drunken plea or tumbling out of someone's bed or whatever, of like, I can't live like this anymore. Like, I need help. And generally the help comes when that moment of clarity extends to a few more moments of clarity, you know, and that window of opportunity is available and there. I used to watch Intervention a lot.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was really interesting to me is the differences between the people that accepted help and the people who didn't. Sometimes earlier in the episode people were ready for help, but the intervention had not yet happened. And by the time they get to the intervention, they're no longer willing. They're like,
it's so...
F you, I hate you, I can't believe you did this. They're very angry. And then sometimes people are just so surrendered, arm behind their back, uncle, I give up, fine, I don't care, you know. And and it's really funny hearing some of the excuses for why they can't go. Right. They have nothing productive happening in their lives. Right. The only productive thing is that they're still breathing. And some of them, it's touch and go.
It's tenuous,
And they're saying things like, well, I have my job. No job. You don't have a job. I have, like, you know.
Games on Saturday.
Yeah, the games on,
like, it's the craziest
ridiculous
stuff.
Ridiculous stuff.
Like,
that,
and I remember being there being like, I can't. I've got school. It's like I was failing. I don't have school. And it really just comes down to that. It's that fear of change.
Sure.
Like, when the, someone once said to me, like, when the pain of staying the same outweighs the fear of change.
That's right.
That's when like willingness emerges and just that seed. And I wish like we had more time to get into some of the patients in the pilot, but, you know, you can tell that some of them don't want to be there.
Sure.
Right. Like you can definitely tell a couple of them, you're not quite sure, but many of them seem forced to being there, which is like kind of what
that's real life though.
It is real life. Like anytime you're forced to make a change, even just I just naturally don't like change. Like
most of us don't.
The other day I went into like a new Starbucks and I was like, this place is horrible. And not because it was horrible, it's because it was different.
Yeah.
And so we get so, like I said, I listen to the same music as I did when I was in high school. It's like we get so accustomed to habits and space and relation already have. That when things change, it's like, and I talk about making a big change. Like when I was 20 years old, I was sitting across from this person that was like, yeah, you, hate to break it to you, kid, but like you need to stop drinking like forever, you know, and it's one day at a time. But like to be 20 years old and have someone tell you that when like all I know is like drinking with my friends.
Right.
Like.
And because it seems so normal. It's like when we sat on that panel at St. Joe's, just I was astounded when I heard that 7,000 students on campus don't drink.
Blew me away.
I thought everyone did.
So did I.
I had no idea. And so it's like, blew me what? Away. Who are these people and where are they? You
know? Like, can you all just like raise your hands?
Yeah. What please? Else are they doing?
And let's hang out. I want to hang out with those
I
people.
I had no idea, you know, yeah. And it just shows that there is other stuff going on that were oftentimes, you know, when I've had some difficult conversations. So how this podcast was born was because I spoke with one of my favorite people. We call each other sister wife. And her name is Stephanie, and she is an amazingly talented photographer. So yeah. When you get out to LA.
Yeah.
She's in Phoenix.
Oh, no, it's not. So I love Phoenix. That was where I went to treatment.
You may
was just outside Phoenix.
Want to connect with her for new headshots.
I will need new ones.
She
yeah.
is, I mean, talk about gift of God. Mm-hmm. Like, gift of God, sweet. Gift from God. Seeing things and capturing life and mm-hmm. moments and realness in a way that I haven't seen in
I'd
a
love
long
to connect
time.
With it. Yeah, yeah.
And so she told me, you should... You have a voice. You should use it. You should start a podcast. And I wept. I was like, so this was in August. I was in Vegas. I wasn't feeling so high because the LA thing didn't work out. Mm. But really, it did work out. The
right.
divine
it's
just redirected
me. You,
totally.
It's usually not our will.
Just not right? my will, yeah. right? And yeah. so I'm weeping. And she's like, tell me about why you're crying. And I was just like, I just saw, you know, like yeah. that ugly cry. And then... Yeah. I spoke a month later. I was talking with another marketing person, David Ratchford, and I'm actually going to talk to him later on today, so he'll be on a future episode about self-care and yoga and his journey.
It's just, I don't mean to, but like, yeah, yeah. I remember one time I was going to play just to use the term like self-care.
Sure.
I was going to play the showcase in Royal Oak, because uh-huh. I'm also a musician, right?
Yeah.
And I was playing the showcase, and it was this beautiful thing I got to be a part of. It was called Collaborations. Mm-hmm. It was in Royal Oak, and it was like this stage thing where people were acting, and I got to kind of act while I was playing guitar. It was amazing. And this, I show up, and this guy goes, "What? We've been rehearsing." So I got to know everyone yeah. really well, and he was like, "So what did you do today?" I go, you know, and because of the program I work, yeah. I was like, you know, just some self-care. And he goes, self-care? What's that? And he meant it. He was like, what do you mean by self-care? And I was like, you know, I just went and, like, paid some bills. I went to, like, get my nails, you know, just some self-care. And he was like, I like that. I'm going to start using that. So it's just funny how we just rattle off these
yeah.
things. And, you know, and you're able to have that language.
Totally.
And we get to teach it to
yes.
other people. So,
and
sorry,
so,
continue.
You know, I do have a part one of self-care this time of year. That's one of the things. That's how I contributed to Carly's life during the shooting and
you
the
did,
production.
You were like, did you? I loved your text, dude. You were like, did you remember, like, self-care today? And I was like, oh. And then I, like, cleaned my apartment. I was like, I'm going to clean my apartment. That way I'm, like, still... And I'm being meditative, and I'm cleaning.
That's right.
Yeah, that
well,
was
true.
We're
all connected. We're all connected, you know. And so he suggested.
Yeah.
Now I was back in Michigan at this point.
Right.
And so this was September. So a month later, he yeah. suggested I do a podcast. And I didn't cry this time. And so I told him. I was
you
like,
gotten the cries out.
Exactly. Yeah. I was like, that's progress. I'm not crying.
Indeed.
Because
yeah.
Originally, I was like, no. And it's like that quote by Marianne Williamson that – essentially, we are afraid to shine. We're afraid to be great. Mm. And it's not so much or always fear. A lot of times it is legit just feeling like, well, what if I succeed?
Right.
Like, because that's terrifying
it
to
is.
Me.
It is. It's so terrifying. And then the other side of that is like, and then it not being enough. You know, like I think about, I was talking to someone yesterday about the now what syndrome, like
sure.
So I just wrapped this pilot production, and Friday night we had this amazing screening, which you were at. Before that, we had this like, we had a little bit of budget left over, so I really wanted to have a nice wrap dinner for my cast and crew, and we
nice.
Had it at the Graduate Hotel, and we did like a white elephant, and we all at this point are kind of like family, because
yeah,
you spend it was 12 shoots, and most of them were 10 to 14 hours, so that's, you know, 150 hours roughly that I'm spending with all these people doing really intimate stuff,
yeah.
creating fiction. And so after we did the showing, and then I went out with a bunch of people, and then the next morning I woke up and I was like, all right, I mean, we have post-production to do and stuff like that, but it was like this big overwhelming feeling of like depression. And I just let it be. And I was like, you know, this is okay. Like, this is normal. It's, and just embrace it and just go meet up with a friend. Don't sit in it and just try to be productive. Go help someone. Like, what can I do? But it's true that you hit these milestones and it can be that really difficult sense of like, now what?
Yeah.
How am I going to top this? How am I going to, you know, and it's not necessarily how am I going to top this? It's like flipping that and be like, what do I get to do next?
That's right. How do I pack into the stream of life?
Exactly.
One of the, my brother told me actually, so I was going to get to the quote, the Marianne Williamson quote that I absolutely love. So my brother told me that there was someone who is like a an MMA fighter.
MMA, yeah.
And she, when she got knocked out, she felt suicidal.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because she had been riding high for so long and
right.
then wasn't, you know? And it's just like, now what?
Yeah, it is. It's now what?
So this is the quote that I absolutely love by Marianne Williamson. It says, our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Mm-hmm. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Mm-hmm. Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you.
Mm.
We are all meant to shine as children do. And I love that because I was at, I was in one of my favorite coffee houses in Vegas.
Like,
I can walk to it from home.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, you almost feel like you're not in Vegas. In this coffee house.
It's funny.
Right? And so, like, you almost feel like you're in Europe somewhere.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And there was this little girl, and she was wearing, like, a pink sundress and cowboy boots.
Mm-hmm.
And a little boy with long hair, and he had a macaron in his hand. And they're just dancing together. And I went up to their mom, and I said, your kids are so free and so beautiful. It's amazing to watch. And I pray for you and for them, that they never lose this spirit.
Yeah.
Right? And she was like, oh my God, that's one of the sweetest things anyone
has ever said. Yeah.
And I say those, like, I say things like that to perfect strangers because I feel like words are important and people need to be affirmed, especially when they're contributing. Because if her two kids continue to be free throughout their lives, imagine how that could look and how that could inspire other people to be free.
It's a ripple effect.
Totally.
You know, and I got to thank my mom for this because when I was growing up, I would always go to the grocery store with her. And of course, I like, you know, hated it. I was like, oh, I just want to stay home and watch TV. And she would bring me because I was like five and I have no business staying home alone, right?
Right.
And we'd go and, you know, she would just talk to everyone. My mom would just talk to everyone. And it annoyed me, and I was like, I just want to go. Where's my candy bar? All these things. And she would talk to the bag boy. We'd be almost out, and it's like, oh, she's got to talk to the bag boy. And I was so annoyed. But and now, like growing up, I realized like how important that is, and like what an incredible thing that is for my mom to be that, and what she taught me, and what she showed me.
That's right.
And that everybody matters, and
that's
everyone
right.
has a story.
That's right.
And now I am my mom, and I'm so proud to say that because now I'm that person like walks in and I just, you know, I have friends everywhere and maybe they're not always receptive, and that's fine. Then I move on to the next person.
Totally.
I don't take it personally, but most people, like, we're just all dying to connect with each
other. That's right. That's what it is.
And we're just dying to connect. We'll die if we don't. I mean, there's that whole study. I used to be a psych major, mm-hmm. so I'm gonna like just butcher this, but there was that study that was like, I'm going to sound so uneducated right now, but it's like that monkey, and like when the monkey is born, it's like a cloth.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
I forget the Skinner, mm-hmm. B.F. Skinner or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like if, basically, the study showed that like if children aren't held, like the physical touch,
sure.
they'll die. And
yep.
and it was just like, it was incredible to
we
kind
were
of like
created for connection.
We were. And I gotta thank my mom for that because today that's just who I am. I'm like,
yeah.
and I have a really loud, distinctive voice. And so it's funny, I go to this place in Ann Arbor. I totally am promoting this right now. It's called Salads Up. They're
okay.
unbelievable. I did some video work for them. They're unbelievable. I walk
in. Is it on Liberty?
It's on Liberty.
Yeah. It's really good.
Like, unbelievable. And it's great. And you can just get any kind of food, like vegan, meat, everything. They've got many options. It's healthy. Yeah. It's quick. And I just, like, know them all at this point because I go there so often. And I walk in and they're like, it's The Voice.
Friends, it reminds me of, like, New York.
Yeah.
Because I love in New York, you can go to those salad places and they, like, make you a chopped salad. Like, they just put everything in a bowl and mix it all together with the dressing and stuff. Unless it's to go, then they'll put it on the side.
It's so nice.
But you just tell them what you want and then they make it happen.
And they're
all, like, magic.
So incredible. And I walk in there and I'm like, they're like, so what are you doing today? And I'm like, oh, I just finished shooting a television pilot. And they're like, oh my God, that's incredible. Like, tell me about it. And I know them to where I walk and they're like, hey, Carly. And I'm like, hey, Stacey. Hey, Nick. Like, I know them. And it's just like, it's really, really nice when you have your Your people are everywhere.
Totally.
And it's just reach out and find them.
Yeah. You know? When I remember being young and we were at a wedding.
Yeah.
And my mom said to, so there were four of us at the time. I'm one of five. And so my sister was young. And was like, my mom says, where is your father?
Mm-hmm.
And my sister was like, he's probably out there knowing somebody. The cutest thing.
It was That's my like, mom.
Right?
She's probably out there making a friend.
Yeah.
You know, and I got to tell you, and it comes back in ways where, like, I had to go to Kroger to pick up food for a shoot. We were shooting in Bloomfield. Mm-hmm. And my mom was like, I set it up with, I forget, she knew her name, right? Yeah. Like, I'm sorry, but it was, you know, it was like with Sandra or whatever. And, mm-hmm. and she's got you covered. And I walk in to pick up this food and I'm stressed and I got to get to set. And, and she's like, I've got it all for you. I gave you an extra thing of chicken. Like, it was just, it was unbelievable. And it's because of that personal touch.
That's right. All relationship.
All the people in that Kroger, like, know what I'm doing. And it's because my mom's told them. And because they are dying in their 12-hour shift from 9 to 9 to connect.
Yeah.
And it's just cool that, like, we get to do that.
It's relationship.
It really is.
And it starts one conversation at a time.
Yeah, you know? It really is.
When you drop your barriers and your guard down just a little bit to let me in, and vice versa, then we can actually have the beginnings of a real conversation.
Yes.
And then that can multiply.
No pretenses.
Exactly.
Just raw, like, person to person.
I remember I was on a church startup and in Vegas, and we were having a team meeting and someone said, well, people aren't going to get real. And I've been in multiple communities and different areas of my life where people are authentic and real because their lives depend on it, essentially, right?
Yes, they do depend on it.
And so I was like, I don't agree with that at all. That's like one of my favorite phrases. If you listen to the podcast, you'll hear me say that a lot.
I don't agree with that at
and
all.
And I say it with a smile because I'm like, it's not – we're not in an argument, you know,
no,
but I was
just,
like, I don't agree with that at all. Leaders lead. That's what my loving life coach says. Leaders lead. And so I go first. Once I go first, you'll likely be inclined at least a little bit of your story. It may not be all of it.
Right.
You may not have that comfort level yet.
Right.
And that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also very weary of people when I know everything about them in 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Like, because I'm just like, okay, you know. But I tend to be that person for people, and a lot of people feel really comfortable telling me a lot of their life in a short period of time.
Yeah.
It's just what it is. And so I remember I was passing out flyers when I first moved to Vegas, and I was working for this company. And we did marketing and promotions, like, on the Strip.
Yeah.
And I learned about this lady's essential life story on the Strip, and she told me everything. And I was just like, okay, so... have you talked to your husband about how you're feeling?
No.
Have you guys tried counseling? Like, and I was just like,
But she'll tell you.
Yeah.
But she's terrified to talk to her husband.
Totally.
You know, it's so true that, like, it is because of that, like, that common bond, you know? And it's interesting what you said about telling too much too soon. There's this episode of The West Wing, which is, like, I obsessed with The West Wing. Like, it was, like, a huge part of my development. And there's the communications director, Toby Ziegler, and the deputy chief of staff, Josh Lyman. They had this bet, and they're throwing stones into, like, this thing, and they're stranded in the middle of America, and they're waiting for their – they miss their bus and stuff, and they're like, whoever misses has to say for the rest of the day, my name is Toby or Josh, and I work at the White House. Like, they have to say that when they – so anyway, Toby ends up missing. So later on in the episode, you hear him say, hi, I'm Toby. I work at the White House. And this kid goes, you know, it'd be a lot cooler if people figure that out for themselves. And it's just the idea of, like, it is a lot cooler sometimes. Like, I don't need to tell you all my like, it's, like, what matters is, like, what's real. And it's just, I always think about that when I'm meeting people. I'm like, you know what, sometimes it's just a lot cooler or better or whatever if people figure out stuff for themselves.
Absolutely.
It's an interesting, you know, what am I, how am I, why am I telling people things about myself, and do I need to?
Totally.
Is it more just to stroke my ego, or is it, am I actually trying to connect? And I find that the more I remove ego from my life, the more I'm actually able to help and be of service to people. And that's what I tried to do with recovering.
Yeah.
I tried to just make it about my experience with recovery.
That's right.
Just as stripped down as possible and true as possible.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a beautiful story. I'm looking forward to it. We should probably wrap up, but we could probably be here all day.
I know.
I'm sure, right?
I'm so happy to try to kick us out of here. So.
Talking. But yeah, no, it is a beautiful, beautiful thing. I will help you all get connected to Carly so that if you feel compelled or led in your heart to, if the spirit shifts in your heart where you want to donate to the cause so that more of these episodes become available to people, because it costs a lot of money to produce and to, you know, take care of the actors and actresses and the team behind the actors and actresses and the musical geniuses that are on there as consultants and anyone that's a part of this project, please feel free to donate. And if you need her for any events that you're doing, she's available as well before she heads over to the land of angels or the city of angels. And I'm just really glad that you're here and that
me
we
too.
Actually had part one. So part two of our conversation may come up. Oh, but I did want to, there was something that we were talking about, and then we will probably wrap up pretty quickly.
I can't remember.
You know what? Because I started to look up what our Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, was talking.
Oh,
you
love
know?
Him. Yeah.
I do, too.
Yeah.
I met him, friends. Like, that is my claim to fame.
I saw him at the Unite to Face Addiction rally.
He
was
is
so inspirational.
Amazing. He
so
came to one of our offices in Vegas when when I was a clinical health coach for the same company I'm with now, but in a different role. So he says that I'm calling for a cultural change in how we think about addiction. For far too long, people have thought about addiction as a character flaw or a moral failing. Addiction is a chronic disease of the brain, and it's one that we have to treat the way we would any other chronic illness, with skill, with compassion, and with urgency. And I love that, because this is a matter of urgency.
It is.
So like I said, if you feel compelled, please do donate to Recovering the TV Pilot so that it's more than just a TV pilot. It becomes multiple episodes so that people around their homes and around screens nationwide can see this good work, because this is a matter of public emergency. Were you going to add something?
Well, I just want to say thank you. This has been like an incredible thing to sit down and talk about and kind of just like deconstruct this process.
Right.
Like, we just finished shooting, and so, and that screening, it's been nice to just kind of sit down and process and really, you know, I think so often we set these lofty standards and goals.
Sure.
And that's great, but we need to realize that it's a win. You know, just completing this and having it impact, even if this just helps one person.
That's right.
Like, it's a win.
That's right.
For everyone involved. So thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about
pleasure.
This. And
it's my pleasure. And so what is our standard, friends, is that we're going to read a couple stories, or I'll read a couple stories to you from Humans of New York. So this cute little boy, he's wearing a pilot's outfit.
He's cute.
Right? So
cute. He's cute.
So they ask, why are you wearing a pilot's outfit? And he says, I wear it every day. Do you want to be a pilot when you grow up? No, I want to be a teacher. Why aren't you wearing a teacher's outfit? I don't have one.
It's brilliant.
Right?
It's just Occam's razor, the simplest answer. You know what I mean?
So,
so brilliant. He's going to be a great teacher.
Right?
Yeah. I don't have one.
And then there's a police officer. He looks like NYPD. And
the whole reason I joined the military was to get away from a bad situation at home. My older brother was one of the leaders of the Latin Kings gang, and he got sentenced to 12 years in prison. He actually got out of prison just as I was going through the police academy, and he even came to my graduation. You know what he told me one time when I visited him in prison right before I deployed for Iraq? He told me, "I'm older than you, but you're my big brother." That was so honest of him, and it really effed me up.
Wow. I feel like that about my sister sometimes. Mm. I'm like, I'm older than you, but like she's so, you know, it's that's nice.
And where is she?
She's at Stanford.
Okay.
So she's studying neuroscience, getting her PhD at Stanford. And she's just my best friend, like brilliant. Like that's awesome. I look up to her in many, many ways.
That's awesome. So it's nice. I feel similarly about my sister too.
Yeah. It's so, we're so lucky to have people like
that. Oh yeah, you know, for sure. Just,
I wouldn't know what I would do without her. So.
Yeah. Well, and that's it. Everyone has a story. Everyone comes to the table with something, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
All right, so I honor the place within you where the entire universe resides. I honor the place within you of love, of light, of truth, of peace. I honor the place within you where when you are in that place in you and I am in that place in me, there is only one of us. So have a great, blessed day, friends. My name is Shadima, the Type A Hippie. Namaste.